Quickly, 20 seconds.
I hope this film gives people a vocabulary and an inspiration for better actions and better conversations. And most importantly, you don't need to hear these things from an Israeli. Palestinians are the most reliable sources, just like we heard from the journalist from Gaza, Muhammad, a few moments ago. And so I really hope that people walk out laughing,
crying, and acting.
We have to
leave it there. Thank you so much, Israeli comedian and activist Noam Eliassi. And I also want to thank Amber Ferris. IFC is where the film is.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. And 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa. The mother of community radio. This is the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York. And we are thrilled to be joined by our very exciting guest today, Ms. Bayork Lee. Bayork, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Richard. I like to just talk and talk and talk about A Chorus Line and not about myself as much, and the company that I formed for Asian actors, National Asian Artist Project. So just shoot away. I'm here.
Well, we thank you for saying that, being so open. This is a good show when you talk and talk, because we go an hour, so we have to fill it. But what I was going to say, basically, to start off with, tell everybody a little bit, because you mentioned A Chorus Line, you mentioned your National Asian Artist Project here in the United States. Tell everybody a little bit about, if you could give like a Reader's Digest version of your career and the different things that you've done within it that we can touch on today.
I was born and raised in New York City, Chinatown. My father had a restaurant. And at five, the casting agents for The King and I came down looking for kids to be with Yul Brynner on Broadway. And we all went uptown, and I got the job at five. So at five, I was on Broadway. And I knew right then and there that I wanted to be in theater. I saw the chandeliers. I saw the velvet seats. I saw people singing and dancing. And I wanted to be in the theater. So from there, I got fired at eight because I outgrew my costume. And but I was very lucky that the choreographer, Jerome Robbins, helped me get into the school that he was involved with George Balanchine, American School of Ballet. And so I got a lot of my training there and stayed there. And then show after show, like 5 or 8 years later, Richard Rogers, they were doing a show called Flower Drum Song. I knew they knew it needed Asian kids. And so I went down and I got that. So I had two Broadway shows under my belt before I went to high school. So I'm a Broadway baby. Performing Arts High School gave me the other training that I needed. When I finished Performing Arts High School, I went straight to Broadway and show after show after show after show. At high school, I met Michael Bennett, who became my mentor later on and who created A Chorus Line. Years later, we found ourselves dancing together. He said, you know, I want you to be a part of my posse, my group. And so I became a Michael Bennett dancer. What else? The rest is history. A Chorus Line, the tape sessions came out of that. I said, you know, who wants to know about a short dancer that wanted to be Asian dancer that wanted to be a ballerina? And he said, let's put it on the stage. So my life is part of the show A Chorus Line, and he named me Connie Wong. At that time also, he was training me to carry the torch, carry on, and to go around the world and set the show. So I'm very, very blessed, Richard, very blessed. It's we celebrated our 50th anniversary in July. I've been all over the world. And Michael Bennett did not like to fly, and so he sent me Asia and to Europe. There you go.
And all over the place. What I found the most fascinating part of that story, and there's many fascinating parts, is that you, I mean, I'm a college student. I'm getting ready to graduate at the end of this year in May. And people say, what do you want to do after school? I have no idea necessarily what I want to do in the business. But you, at 5 years old, knew what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. What was that kind of like that you said at like 5 years old, I want to be on Broadway? Like, what's that kind of feeling like?
Well, I had examples. I had examples. I had Yul Brynner as the actor. Yuriko was part of the Martha Graham Company, very famous modern dance company. I had Jerome Robbins, the choreographer, who was partners with George Balanchine, who ran New York City Ballet. I had the best mentors that I could look up to. And so at five, this is what I want to do. There was no doubt about it. I knew I wanted to dance, and I love the theater. I love that St. James Theater. I've played that theater four more times after The King and I, and just played theater after theater across the street, the Majestic Theater with Sammy Davis, and down the street, the Broadhurst Theater, you know, on and on and on. And I just loved being a Broadway baby.
And so when did you, because you were saying five, you discovered Broadway. Obviously, dance is going to be a very big topic with this interview. When did you first realize your love of dance and the power of, like, what it could do for you?
At five, six, seven, eight, because I was watching every single night the ballet that Yuriko danced, all the dancers and the singers, and I would imitate them. I had no dance training, but I imitated them, and I knew I could do it. And at the end of 3 years, I could do the whole ballet, and I knew everybody's part, and I knew everybody's lines in the show. Yeah, at 8 years old, I was directing the kids. We were on the eighth floor, and there were 14 of us, and I was already directing them, you know, and doing The King and I, and you're going to play the king, and you're going to do this. Never, ever, ever thinking that I would be directing.
I know you loved performing. Did you ever think, because we could transition into, you were a dancer, you've danced in tons of Broadway shows, and then you kind of got a chorus line. And that kind of was what changed everything, I would say, for you, no?
It wasn't a chorus line. It was the show Promises, Promises. I don't know, every Thanksgiving they show Turkey Lurkey, the show Promises, Promises. You have to look that up. I was featured with Donna McKechnie and Margot Sappington, and we did this dance, Turkey Lurkey, and I just loved performing. And then one day, Michael Bennett said to me, I'm going to train you to be dance captain, and the dance captain had to take care of all the show. If anybody was out, you had to put new people in the show. And so he started training me then. And then when that show closed after 3 years, he allowed me to go around the country and set his choreography of Promises, Promises, which started to give me the background that I needed for a chorus line. And then shortly after that was Seesaw. I became his assistant and dance captain. An assistant, I was there to help create the show, which is very different from being a dance captain because you're there after the fact. But as an assistant, I was there every day helping him to create the show. And then came a chorus line. I think I was ready. But I wasn't ready to perform my life on the stage. And so I knew that I was going to be involved with the show. But he said, I want you to be in the show. So I was the dance captain. I was the assistant. Opening night, he said, you're going to take this around the world. And I went, oh, yeah, sure. Because some of those shows only lasted a couple of months that we were in. And here I am 50 years later, going to do the Macy's Day Parade with the next generation. They will be doing the Combination One. We celebrated our 50th anniversary in July. And at the Schubert Theater, where we started, we ran for 15 years. You know, in all of that, as I went around the world directing and choreographing on my own, and I got the chance to direct and choreograph Jesus Christ Superstar, which I was in the film with Norman Jewison, around Europe, I met an actor in the show. And when it was over, when that tour was over, he called me up and he said, listen, I've just got a job in South Africa at Stellenbosch University, and they want to start a musical theater to help the townships be more aware of AIDS. Would you come and help us? And so I went to Cape Town, to Stellenbosch University, and I helped them develop a musical theater, wrote shows to go into the townships. Wonderful. And I would go every World AIDS Day, December the 1st, and to help them fundraise the university. So I have a big heart and love for South Africa and Professor Jan du Toit. He's retired now, but we're still in touch.
That's excellent. Well, I think what you kind of touched on there is because we could talk about the power of dance and theater and all those wonderful things. But I think what the real power of it is when you were in South Africa, you formed the musical theater school to help people discuss the topic of AIDS. right? And I think something that's powerful that the arts and theater and dance and any of that can do is it really can help, like, communicate a message to people and make them view something differently because their defenses are down. Tell us about that experience a little more while we're on this show that airs all over Cape Town.
That was an experience that I never knew that I could reach that far, because putting the show on around the world, it's a set show. I'm working with dancers and singers and actors, and here I am at the university, and we are developing shows to talk about AIDS. And what was wonderful is that at the end of the show, they would have a nurse in the back, and the last song was Know Your Status, because so many people, they do not want to know if they have it or not. And so it has been over 10 or 15 years now that they have had over 100,000 people see this show and go after the show because they understand that it's important to know your status and get tested. And so I never thought that I could reach that far out, that theater could reach that far out. But then I was sitting there saying, I haven't done anything for my own community. And so I came back to Chinatown, where I grew up, and I formed the National Asian Artists Project for Asian artists to be a part of the theater doing Western shows. And I started an after-school program in Chinatown to give those kids an opportunity that I had. So we take them to see Broadway shows. We go uptown. We take them to museums. So things that I didn't have. So I'm gone back to my community, and that's what I'm doing now.
The Know Your Status thing, just for a moment, if we could go back to that for a second. That's okay. Powerful. Because you always hear about examples of people like the arts changing lives, but that really is an example of the arts changing lives.
Yes, absolutely. And I think they enjoyed the show because Professor said, we go into the townships and we have clipboards and we give them statistics and, but that doesn't mean anything. But when his idea of doing a musical theater, and they know the songs, we take very familiar songs, from Tina Turner on back, and then add lyrics to them. And there's a lot of comedy, very serious talks, about how you can contact it and how you can help to have condoms and things like that. But all in humor. And with the humor, they just love the show, and singing, and come on, get tested. Go right back in the back of the house. There's a nurse back there. Know your status. It worked.
You took the words right out of my mouth. It worked. It really did. But we were talking about changing lives before we got on the air. For those who might not be familiar with A Chorus Line, because we did mention it, we're going to talk quite a bit about it. Explain what A Chorus Line is, what it's about, and kind of the effect that it had on you guys personally who were in it, and the audience. Because I think that's another example about people coming up to you on the street and saying, this show changed my life. And
well, Michael Bennett had always wanted to work with dancers and actors, and he was a choreographer, so he basically worked with dancers. Of course, he branched out to become a director. We were doing a show called Seesaw, and two dancers, they had heard that Broadway was dying. They'd come all the way from St. Louis and all over parts of the United States and the world to get to Broadway. And if Broadway is dying, first thing that goes are the dancers. What are we going to do? So they decided that they would group together to talk about it. So a lot of their friends were on Broadway shows. They couldn't get it together. So they thought, we'll get Michael Bennett, the up-and-coming choreographer, and people will want to work with him. And so they called Michael Bennett, and of course, everybody said yes. And he was very smart because he brought a tape recorder, and it was a 24-hour session, and people just danced, because that's the thing that we have in common. And then he sat everybody around, and he said, why did you come to New York? How did you get into the business? And that went on for 24 hours, and it went around the room, and these are the stories that are in the show. He took those tapes to Joseph Papp because he said, is this a book? Is this a movie? Is it a Broadway show? The stories are so incredible. You know, they're funny. They're emotional. It ran the gamut. And so he took the tapes to Joseph Papp. And Joseph Papp listened to them and he said, I don't know what this is, but it's something. I mean, these people and the story. So he said, I will give you a skeleton crew. I will give you a theater and I'll give you time. You develop something. We don't know what it is. I am glad that he went to Joseph Papp because at that time he was the experimental theater. I mean, it was either Broadway or off Broadway, but Joseph Papp's theater, he developed new writers, new actors. I mean, Hamilton started there. So we were in a workshop, and of course I was part of Michael Bennett's team, and we started to develop the show and use some of the stories that was part of the tape sessions. And we had two workshops, and then Michael said, we need to bring music in. And we had done a show with Marvin Hamlisch. And so he called up Marvin, who had just won two Oscars. And he said, I'm doing this thing. We don't know what it is. We have no name for it. It's a, you know, work in progress. And Marvin said, listen, I just won two Oscars. You know, I can't go back to do, you know, making $25 a week. But he convinced Marvin, and Marvin came in and he heard the stories and he started to compose. And the rest is history, because then the famous lighting designer, Theron Musser, came on board. The famous costume designer came on board. The famous set designer, Robin Wagner, came on board. And we had a team. And so we opened off Broadway, 1975, May 21st. Then Michael Bennett immediately, he said, we got to get to Broadway. And so in July 25th, we opened on Broadway. And that's what I've been celebrating for 50 years. And we ran for 15 years at the Schubert Theater. There's a plaque. If you go into the Schubert Theater and you come out the doors, you will see the plaque, a chorus line, 15 years at that theater. Because shows didn't run more than 2 years or, you know, a year. But we ran for 15 years. And of course, now you have Phantom of the Opera, 35 years, and you've got Cats, you know, 20 years, and Lion King, and you've got all of that. But at that time, we were the first. We were the first reality show. We were the first show that ran for 15 years. First show that had a lighting board, because before that, men would be downstairs pulling levers and pulling ropes. And Theron Musser, she invented the lighting board, which was very large, but now it's as small as a computer. All you have to do is, program it, and you've got your lights for a lot of things.
And what I like is that you said it's the first reality show, because you guys took your real stories and you put them on stage and basically were playing yourselves. They changed the names. But what's amazing about that is we were talking before also about how kind of the lyrics and the stories and how it relate to people all over the gamut, whether you are in the performing arts or not. And then you have people, I assume, because you're talking about changing lives, come up to you on the street and say, this show changed my life for those reasons. Tell me a little about that, what the effect of having people respond so powerfully to your stories was.
Everyone, if you've seen a chorus line and it has affected you in some way, because they are 19 characters and they're all different, and you can sit back and say, oh my God, that's my mother, or that's my brother, or that's my sister, or I have a friend, you know, talk about infidelity, talk about homosexuality, which at that time, people did not talk of. In 1975, you did not hear a character say that he was molested as a child and he was gay. I mean, you know, there's so many people would walk out of the theater. And of course, they would walk out of the Paul monologue. And he is the character for 8 minutes that talks about his life. That was Nicholas Dante's real life that he went through as a child. So there's a girl that can't sing. There's a tiny little Asian that was not tall enough. I mean, it goes on, it runs the gamut. And so there is somebody in this show that you can relate to. And it does change people's lives. I would get letters from little dancers, not only Asian, and they said, you know, I left New York because I couldn't get a job. You had to be 5'5 and blonde and this and that and the other. And you have proven that you can work. You can do shows. And I'm coming back to New York and I'm going to try. We also got letters from people. Our anthem is What I Did for Love that Marvin Hamlisch wrote for us. And that's the end of the show. We do it for love. At 5 years old, I didn't say, how much am I going to make? Or anybody going to a dance class or who does a play in school. They don't say, well, how much am I going to make? Or am I? You do it because you love to do it. And if you were in the wardrobe or an usher at theater or any job, a lawyer, you do it because you really love what you do. And Marvin wrote this song for us. And that means a lot. People left their jobs and said, when I heard that song, I said, I don't like what I do. I need to quit and I need to find out what I love. And that changes, the show has changed so many people's lives. Or they want to be in theater. They want to be on that stage. And we have Austin Koo, who went to school as a lawyer, wanted to be an actor, got all of his papers and said, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to go into a courtroom. I want to be on that stage. And Austin Koo, and now he's a director. So it has changed people's lives.
That's got to be such a rewarding feeling, reading that through the years, because you also took it. I'm curious, because that was the response in New York. You've took this show international. You've done it all over the world. And so how the response has been different to the show all over the world where you've done it? Because you've done it in Spain. You've done it London, everywhere you've done it. So how's responses changed?
No different, because people are the same all over the world. You look at the show in Italy with Antonio Banderas playing Zach, and you go to South Korea those characters are there and you can relate to them. And the laughs are in the same place. The tears are in the same place. The tears are in the same place with the Paul monologue and the poor girl who can't sing, you know, and she's up against all of these people who can sing and she's just, you know, terrified. It goes on and on and on. And I have been all over the world and it's the same. It is exactly the same. The response. We went to Shanghai with the subtitles, and we've been to Japan with the subtitles. And they are still in tears. They are still laughing. They are still involved. They are still emotionally involved with this show. And I really think that is why it has lasted this long. There are other shows, you know, Carousel, Oklahoma. They've, you know, been around for more than 50 years, and they have lasted also. Those are the classics. And I'm so happy to say that A Chorus Line has become one of the classics.
Yes, it has. And what you said was just so good, because this show is really about capturing the human condition, how we're, no matter where you are in the world, whether you're in New York or whether you're in South Africa or no matter where you are, we're still kind of the same people. We want the same things. We feel the same things. And so the fact that you took this show to everywhere imaginable all over the world and people felt the same things just goes to show just the power of what the human condition is and how we are all more alike than we might seem, even though we're different from afar.
Yes. And I think in this time, 2025 and this time, I think we need What I Did for Love, What I Did for Love, and stand up for it.
And something else that I wanted to ask, because you were saying 50 years, you guys did a big benefit concert, because it's kind of the thing of, you obviously you can't see, when anyone's going after a dream, it's very vulnerable. There's a big risk involved in what you guys did putting it up, because you had said stuff doesn't last, let alone 5 months on the stage, let alone 50 years. What was that whole night like, and feeling like, wow, we really did this? That had to be incredible. And then we were saying before, the flash mob and the standing ovations.
Well, you know, it all stems from, in 1983, a Coors Line passed Greece. And Michael Bennett in the Schubert Alley, he put on a show. He brought everybody who'd ever done the show. We had five companies out. We had a company in Australia, a company in London, three companies in the United States. He brought one person from all of the international companies, and there were about 500 dancers on that stage. They had to brace the stage. That was in 1983, and I looked at that tape at the New York the public library, and I said, I can't top this. This is 50 years. I cannot top this. What can I do? And so it took me a while, but I got together with Donna McKechnie, Talento, Kelly Bishop, and Priscilla Lopez, and myself, and we said, we can do this. We can put this together. And at the end, I had 40 dancers in the aisles. I didn't have 500, but we talked about how the show started. So Wayne started with the tape sessions, and then we brought in Jay Johnson to do, and I had five different mic characters. And then Kelly Bishop came out and talked about the atmosphere on Broadway at that time. And then she brought her cover out. You know, so we're passing it on to the next generation. And Priscilla Lopez came out and she sang Nothing and talked about how her experience at Performing Arts High School, when her teacher said, you'll never be an actress, you know, and here she is now, you know, won her Tony Award. So she talked about that, and she sang, that's her song, Nothing, is about that teacher telling her that she would be nothing, that she would be nothing. So we went on and on and on, and that's the only way we won. We could get $1 million for the entertainment community. It was a huge success. And I thought, you know, how the seats were like going for $10,000. And I said, I think we need to invite everyone around the world who has done the show. Let's do a flash mob. And that I went to the public library and I said, we want to do it, you know, at Lincoln Center. And they said, absolutely. So we had over 300 people coming from all over the world doing one. You can see it on YouTube. And just celebrating that, you know, some of them had been on the road tours. Some have been in London, Austria, you know, their resume says I've done seven companies of A Chorus Line, and now I'm a grandmother. So, yeah, 50 years later, you know, people do have lives. There is a life after A Chorus Line.
And you have said before we got on, you never get tired of talking about it. 50 years later, never get tired of talking about it. You've never had someone come to you on the street and say, I want to tell you about A Chorus Line, and you go, this again. And you've never had that moment?
I love that moment because they're going to tell me about their experience. And I know my life or somebody's life from the original company has affected them. And I represent the original company. You know, when I was performing, and then Michael sent me to Australia to direct, then I went back to performing, and then he sent me to Stockholm. I performed, and finally I told the original company, I can't perform anymore. The machine is getting, you know, too wound up, too many companies. And I said, I promise you, I will always represent you. And so I'm still in touch with them. I let them know what I'm doing. They came. Some of them came to the theater, flew all the way in. We've lost a lot of them. I made sure that I gave them their honor and their contribution to the show. We had a beautiful tape of those who have passed away in memoriam. I had two wonderful young producers, Chris Kettner, Hunter Regan. They were the producers of Sunset Boulevard on Broadway, and they were the ones that said, what do you want to do, Bayork? We will produce it for you. Just so grateful to them that they understood how much it meant to so many people around the world. You can't imagine. And I'm sure Hamilton is going to do the same thing, because they're educating people also, and they're helping so many communities talk about American history. But they're doing it in different languages also. God bless Lin-Manuel. And he started in our footsteps. He started the public theater. Then he moved to Broadway. And now he's gone all around the world with different companies. And so he's following us.
And what I also like about the topic of education is, and it's kind of full circled, you just seem to have a lot of full circle moments in this conversation, which is great, because you said when you were 5 years old and then 50 years later and all of that, but when you were 8 and you started teaching everybody else the dances and knowing all the lines, and you seem to take on the nurturer mentor role well, which has suit you well with your National Asian Artist Project here in the States. Will you touch on a little bit earlier? Tell people how the ball got rolling there. I know it kind of came out of what you were doing in South Africa, but how you kind of got started with that. And yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I was sitting in South Africa and I said, you know what? I'm helping so many people, but I haven't helped my own community. And so I came back. I was doing The King and I, and I had two assistants. And I said, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, where do all these talented Asians go? And they said, they wait for the next King and I, or they wait for the next Saigon, because, you know, they're only taking one Asian in a show. And so we decided to start National Asian Artist Project, and that is to bridge Western world with the Eastern world, which are the Asian actors. And we do Western shows. We do Oklahoma, Carousel, Hello Dolly, Into the Woods, Oliver, all Asian cast. And from that, I went back to one of the schools in Chinatown, and I have an after-school program with 35 kids, and that's been there for 15 years. And of course, they graduate, and we get a whole new bunch of kids, and they're there from, they're 8 to 11, and they're with me for 3 years. And I'm so proud to say that two of those students went to musical theater colleges, and they are on Broadway. And they are, you know, on tour and on Disney ships and things like that. So if I only get two out of, you know, from 15 years that really want theater, I'm very happy. But let me tell you, a lot of them are so smart. They go to Cornell, they go to Harvard and Yale. But when they come back as alumni, they say, we were in the theater club at 8 to 11 years old. We got to do monologues. We got to talk in front of people. I took them to the Junior Theater Festival down in Atlanta, where they perform in front of 6,000 other kids. And they're 8 years old, and they're terrified. But here they are now at Yale, and at, you know, and they, this is nothing. We've been at the Junior Theater Festival performing for 6,000 kids. And so it really helps. It helps the self-esteem. It helps them in so many different ways. It's not only wanting to be in theater.
And we had said that before we came on, because I had said to you that I grew up doing theater and doing plays. And I said, I kind of walked away from it a little bit. You said, well, we still need people to fill the seats. But I think it's true. I think there are life skills that you take away from that about confidence, because you're being vulnerable. And vulnerability is a big thing that a lot of people struggle with, no matter where you are. And I think that's something that's really big.
Oh, very big. But also, we have tiger moms. You know, those are the moms that when you get out of school, you're taking violin, you're taking a math course, and until you go to bed. They come to theater club and we ask them to use their imagination and to improvise and to be animals and to march and to, you know, they get to talk. They, you know, they get to communicate. And that's so important because all from 8:30 in the morning until the end of school and to the end of the day, their parents have them, you know, in a class. But when they come to theater club, they are so happy. They come screaming and yelling and crawling on the floor. And yes, use your imagination. And how do you feel about this? And we ask them, how do you feel? What would you do? And learning the Annie script or learning the Beauty and the Beast script, you know, how would you say this line? Use your imagination. Yeah, it's important.
Critical thinking skills that
and
can
also,
be applied.
Yeah. Also, when I went to pitch course to the principal, I said, listen, you use only a half of your brain. You know, you only use that side, you know, the academic side. We need the artistic side. We need a whole human being, you know. And so that's really important that you have both sides. And when I said that, she said, yes, you can come to the school. And the parents understand that also. You know, it's not only learning an instrument because you're reading notes and it's very regimented. You know, this is about being free and being yourself and finding out who you are.
And finding out who you are. And I think kind of something else that you had said, I feel like for you, what's got to be like, as you were saying about the audiences writing letters to you, when those kids come back and tell you the impact that you and this program made on them, that has to be better than any standing ovation or anything?
Anything. I just went to the Red Bull Awards. It's the International Chinese Film Festival. And they come to New York. And, of course, they, you know, they give out awards to the local schools, to kids who they feel are, you know, have a great potential. And one of my boys who started with me at 8 years old, William Hsu, he won. And I was there at Symphony Space. I was just in tears. There he was. And he wants to go to musical theater school at NYU or any musical theater school. So then I would have three, you know, and he wants to be on Broadway. Yes. It doesn't matter. I can get a Tony Award, but my Tony Award is seeing my students get up there and achieve.
And something else that's good, too, is that you have not only this in Chinatown, New York, but you have stuff in Japan and in Korea. And so describe that a little bit, too, that you have all these programs running.
Yes. I opened a school in Tokyo. The SKD school, we had a school, the Lotte World School, South Korea. Oh, and those students, one is a professor at the university, one is a star, the sitcoms. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I'm in touch with them. I'm so proud of them.
And so I have this question now for you. We always ask this whenever educators come on in any capacity, come on this show, mentors, educators, all the students learn stuff from you. What is the biggest thing that you have learned from your students?
From the students?
Yeah, what is the biggest thing they've taught you through the years in your programs?
They have taught me to be a better director. And I say that over and over again. You make me a better director because I have to find the way to teach you how to do all the things that's needed in a show. And everybody's different. Everybody's learns in a different capacity. You know, some are fast, some are slow. You have to explain it 5 times before they understand what you're trying to say. But I'm also asking for your input. So the students have taught me to be a better director.
Any personal like life lessons that they've taught you about like maybe not taking certain things seriously, anything else in life? Not even about like professional in the professional arts, but I'm trying like personal things, stuff that you've taken away stuff they've said to you?
I invest in my shows and the people in my shows. And I think more than anything else, they have given me a life because I have dedicated my life to the show, to theater. But it's because of the students. It's because of the actors. They have given me a life. That's what I've taken away from them.
And going back to something, before doing this interview, you got profiled on a show here in the States, CBS Sunday. You had a very nice profile done on you. And in recognition of all this humanitarian work with the National Asian Artist Project, you got to receive the very prestigious Isabel Stevenson Tony Award, which is like a humanitarian award for all this work. What did that, I know you said the hearing from your students is the award, but the award has to feel pretty nice itself. What, tell me about that whole experience, what that meant to you.
Michael, I owe everything to Michael Bennett and Bob Avian, who gave me this opportunity, this little kid that wanted to just dance. And they took me and groomed me and gave me this position. I want to give the awards to them. But, you know, I have dedicated my more than half my life to the show and to theater. And so to be recognized, you know, at one point I was, you know, so humble. And then all of a sudden I went, I've worked very hard every single day. I've done over 50 companies. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. And accepted with my chin up.
Did you hear from all the kids that you've mentored when that happened?
Yes, 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 yes. My emails, you know, and my phone and phone calls. Yes, all of them. All of them from all over the world, you know, especially for the Tony Awards. Yeah. And I did thank Professors Yonda Toy and Jimmy Perry, Professor Jimmy Perry from Stellenbosch University. I thank them in my Tony Award because going out to South Africa changed me because I became aware that I needed to help my community. Also, I became aware of, I got so educated on AIDS and how far I could, my tentacles could reach. So I had to thank them in my Tony Award speech.
What do you think? We're getting towards the end of our conversation here. You've had such a beautiful career with so many like moments. Even listening to you, you were kind of just like from Time of Five and directing and then everything with A Chorus Line, now with the kids. It's so funny. You started teaching the kids and you're still teaching the kids all these years later. It's funny.
It really is. I don't know. I think more than a director, I think I'm a teacher. You know, I'm a teacher. When I have to, Michael Bennett said to me, when you're casting A Chorus Line, take your time because 75 to 80% is in your casting. If you get the right actor, you know, you don't have that much to do. And so there is the poem, 8-minute Paul monologue. I really take the time and I break everything down. I listen to their stories and how they can connect. They also teach me how to be patient and also listen to what they have to contribute to the role. It's really, really important. Yeah.
So what in that Paul monologue are people really saying? Because that's kind of just another moment of like the power of what the performing arts could be. So what is going on in that Paul monologue?
That Paul monologue is, he doesn't really want it. Everybody on the line wants to talk about themselves because they want the job. Yes, they're there for the job. And he wants the job also. He's just had an operation on his knee. And but he doesn't want to let the director know that he was a drag queen. And so he hides it through the monologue throughout the show until the director says, there's something here that, you know, I want to hear this story. And so he finally opens up and he talks about being Sid Charisse dancing on the street and how he was bullied at school. And so the principal told him, you know, then quit. She sent him to a psychiatrist. He went to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist tells him to quit school. And so he did. And he started hanging around 42nd Street and Needle Park, meeting strange people. And then he was introduced to the Jewel Box Revue, and he joined it and became a drag queen. And he toured with them. He also tells a story about being very young, his father taking him to the movies. And because he couldn't see, he'd move up front. And these strange men would come and play with him. He'd go to the bathroom and they would molest him and things like that. So at the 1975, that was very strong. And when we did the revival in 2009, we thought, oh, well, you know, gay marriages and it's okay. People were still moved by that monologue. They are still moved by it in any language.
And what I love kind of is, as we're getting towards the end of this here, moved by any language. This whole discussion has been such a power of the performing arts, because all over the place you've taken these shows and you've seen what it's done for the, even the performing arts has done for the kids, no matter who you are, the human condition, South Africa, all over the place. Describe, as we head out for the listeners, why you think the performing arts are so powerful and how it appeals to the human condition and why you think people should really care about this and the arts.
First of all, arts education is really important to start young, to start them young, to be aware of themselves and who they are and giving themselves confidence. But the arts, how can I say it? There's so much going on in this, hate going on in this world, so much going on, turmoil and all of that. You go into the theater and the performing arts, you have the actors reaching out to you, whatever the story is, you become involved. Performing arts is so, so important because the human conditions are, you know, sometimes we can't change that, but you go into the theater and your life is changed.
And sometimes it changes your life. And that's it. And that's the beauty of it. And that's why, as we've said before, people should go to the theater.
People should go to the theater.
And yeah. I'm gonna keep going, Bayark. I'll see you on stage.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming on. I know you mentioned something very exciting about, in the United States, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. People should be on the lookout for that. Describe that one more time before you head out.
Yes, I got the offer to do the Thanksgiving Day Parade, and it's a chorus line, Next Generation, and I'm auditioning musical theater high schools like LaGuardia and Frank Sinatra, NDI, some college students, and they're going to do the combination one. So I'm trying to keep Michael Bennett and Bob Avian's legacy, their choreography, going on forever into the next generation. And so everybody, I hope, will be watching the Thanksgiving Day Parade. We'll be in front of Macy's doing one.
Bayark, and if anyone wants to find out more about you and the National Asian Artist Project, where can people turn to?
We have a website, naapproject.org. And then, yeah, you can come to our website and see what we're doing.
Hi. Okay, well, Bayark Lee, thank you very much for coming on our show today. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Keep it up. Keep it up. Keep it up.
Thank you. You have been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jullie.
Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year. Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.LymeDiseaseAssociation.org.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.